And welcome to episode 56 of Did You Bring the Hummus podcast. I'm Kimberly, your host, and I'm super excited to be here with you today. Did You Bring the Hummus is a podcast to help you go vegan. This season, I'm sharing new episodes every Monday discussing all things vegan. Most importantly, we'll talk about how to embrace this meaningful decision with fervor and fun. Episodes post every Monday on your favorite podcast app. Before we get started, I have one very important question for you. Did you bring the hummus? Today, I am joined by author Victoria Moran. Listed by Veg News among the top 10 living vegetarian authors, Victoria Moran has written 13 books, including Creating a Charmed Life, Younger by the Day, and Main Street Vegan. Featured twice on Oprah and host of the Victoria Moran podcast, Meetings with Remarkable Women, Victoria has studied yoga since the late 1960s and did her yoga teacher training at age 70. She has a degree in comparative religions and has studied the spirituality of daily life in India and Tibet. She is the founder of the Main Street Vegan Academy, training and certifying vegan lifestyle coaches and educators since 2012. Lead producer of the 2019 documentary, A Prayer for Compassion, about food choices and spirituality, and co-founder of the Compassion Consortium, an online interfaith spiritual center for people who care about animals. She lives in New York City with her husband, interfaith minister William Melton, adopted Chihuahua Rupert, and rescue pigeon Thunder. In this episode, we talk about how amazing being vegan is. Big surprise there. Victoria's experience at the Parliament of World Religions, aging well as a vegan, her vegan coach training program, the Main Street Vegan Academy, and the Compassion Consortium, and so much more. Let's get into it. You'd rather hear Victoria tell you about these things anyway. Hey, Victoria, thanks for joining me.
Well, thanks for having me.
I am so excited about this conversation. Aww. We have so many interesting topics to cover. So let's just dive right in.
Let's dive.
Let's start with your vegan journey. Share that with us.
You know, my vegan journey is 40 years old, and it was precluded by about 12 years vegetarian plus working up to that. So I'm going to remember that I'm a New Yorker and talk really fast. When I heard the word vegetarian when I was 5 years old, I knew there was something in it for me. But I was living in Kansas City, Missouri, which at that time had the biggest stockyards in the country, second to Chicago. We were known for steak and barbecue. I didn't know why this vegetarian thing seemed to say something to me, but it did. And I actually tried to go meatless when I was 13 and lasted about 3 months. I ate cottage cheese and fruit cocktail and finally just got so hungry, I gave in to my mom's roast beef. And I always think about that when people say, oh, I tried to be vegan. It was so hard. And I always say, did you eat enough? Yeah. Because, you know, sometimes you're just hungry. So when I finally made it to vegetarian, I was 18 and I had moved to London, which was, you know, swing in London and the Beatles were there. And of course I wanted to be there, but I really, really love how I think really whatever you want to get into a country that's really old has more history of that. Mm-hmm. So the vegan movement really took off there in the mid 19th century. And I didn't hear about vegans when I was there, even though veganism started there, but I did get off land animals, got off sea animals when I came back home. And the veganism was tough. I mean, it was so tough. I heard about it. I was dealing with a binge eating disorder that made it really hard. Plus, we're talking the 1970s. I mean, there was nothing. I remember when they put the first salad bar in Kansas City, I thought they did it for me because I was a vegetarian. And so, you know, I wish it had been faster, but it took as long as it took. And I finally made it in 1983. My daughter had been born and I wanted to raise her vegan, but I knew I had to do it first. And I had also gone back after many years of going and not going to Overeaters Anonymous and got the power of choice in what I would eat, which I don't think I'd ever had before in my life. And once I got that, I chose vegan and never looked back. So my 40th vegan anniversary will be in November.
Yay. Congratulations.
Thanks.
That's so wonderful. What a great story. I too, went back and forth a little bit, and I think I didn't know the word vegetarian, you know, as a kid, but it always felt like there was something I was missing and I hadn't been able to put a finger on it. And then I heard about vegetarianism probably as a teenager. Some of my friends were doing it because they thought it helped them lose weight. And I was like, that's interesting, but I didn't like vegetables.
Yeah.
So I wasn't really open to it, and I didn't know how to cook. And I didn't think my mom would cook for me if I was like, make me a fully separate meal.
Right.
And so I didn't think about it again. But I was, you know, going with my friends to Bath and Body Works and reading the labels to see, has this been tested on animals? But then meeting them for a cheeseburger afterwards.
Yeah.
And so it was slowly like coming in. And then, you know, I got to college and I was a philosophy major. I took, I took an ethics class and started to kind of really hear it from that perspective, and would still then go to the, you know, to go get lunch and still same thing, you know, eating cheeseburgers and whatever and pizza and not thinking twice about it while I was eating. And then I read an issue of PETA's Animal Times, which showed up in my mailbox. Still no idea how, but so thankful it did. And that started my vegetarianism. And then eventually I finally went vegan for good in 2015.
Cool.
Yeah.
It's such an interesting story that how we can get certain aspects first, because when I was a sophomore in high school, I was just outraged that they expected us to dissect all these creatures in biology class. And I fully agreed to transfer into a non-college credit class, even though it meant I would have a bleak future because I was not going to cut up those animals. And my teacher, as he was given the pass to sign to get me out of his class, he said, "So you don't want to hurt any animals?" I'm like, "Absolutely not." He's like, "But you eat them, don't you?" And it was like, oh, how can you see through me like that? You're supposed to be a biology teacher, not the psychic hotline. But I said, "I do, but I won't always." He said, "You know what? I believe you. Good luck to you, kid." And I had some good luck.
Yeah.
And it, you know, I think it's just so acultural. And especially when we want to do it when we're kids and don't really have a lot of autonomy and are so dependent on adults, it's tricky. But I think it's so sweet to talk to people who ended up being vegan and they had these glimpses of it early on, even before they could put it into practice. Yeah. So I just try to be real nice to my past self. And every time I messed up, because I know my future self is going to mess up, maybe not with food, but she's going to mess up.
I know too. I also worked through a binge eating disorder, and I would, you know, it was for me, there was no like purging afterwards. It was literally just binge eating.
Mm-hmm, me too.
And I would go to the store and I'd get all the snacks and then I would like black out, and then I'd come to and be surrounded by that. And I think people were kind of afraid when I started thinking, and I went vegetarian overnight. So I think they were like, "Well, you're not going to stick with this because you don't stick with anything." And which was kind of my MO before that. And also, like, you have this other issue you're dealing with. How are you going to face that while trying to not eat all the things that you're used to eating? But I made my way through, you know, it was separate, not, you know, it didn't. I know there are some people who believe that people go to vegetarianism or veganism when they're dealing with an eating disorder because it's a way to hide the eating disorder. Mm-hmm. And for me, I felt so strongly about the animal piece of it, and that I didn't want to contribute to that anymore, that I knew that I could kind of keep them separate and it wouldn't kind of muddy everything.
I completely relate. And I think if we're ethical vegetarianism and veganism, it works that way. I mean, I would imagine that if somebody was just doing it for health or to lose weight, it would be like any other diet, unless they got this other piece that somebody else is involved. And I've always been fascinated by reports that women who are alcoholic and can't go 9 days without a drink, often, not always, unfortunately, but often can go 9 months when they're pregnant, because somebody else's life is at stake there. Yeah. And I think it's like that, you know, with the animals. Now, for me, I was able to be vegetarian before I got recovery from my eating disorder. Couldn't be vegan because I just couldn't hold out. And maybe nowadays I could, because there's so much, you know, vegan, like really concentrated, sweet, salty, the kind of food that is good to binge on. So if people haven't binged, you want a concentrated fix. You don't want to have to eat celery for 2 hours.
Right.
But if everything else in the house is gone, the celery is okay. I mean, ideally you're going to dip it in mayonnaise or something, so it's not just celery. Right. But you know, you're really going for this concentrated fix. And with veganism, back in the old days, when we really had to do what people now are calling whole food plant-based, because that's what we had. I mean, we had potato chips. We had Coca-Cola, but not a lot of stuff. So I remember I would binge a lot on trail mix. And I thought, this is the weirdest thing, because I can eat raisins. And, you know, when I've had enough, I'll stop. And I can eat nuts. When I've had enough, I'll stop. But you mix those two together and it's like lost weekend. So it's really interesting. But, you know, the one thing I'll say on that, people whose eating disorders were on the other side, more the anorexic side of things, they're so often dissuaded from going vegan because it looks like a ploy to not eat. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure that for some people, it is that or has been that. But on the other hand, I just feel like anybody who's got some kind of handle on their condition and is doing okay a day at a time, I just hope they're not being kept from being vegan, because it's the most uplifting, and it brings about so much self-esteem. You know, you just know every day that you can't change the world, but you changed somebody's world just by your choices that day. So I hope that everybody who wants that can have that experience.
Yeah, I hope so too. I say that going vegan is the most beautiful decision I've ever made. It's the most powerful, but it is the most beautiful decision I've ever made. Mm. And I'm so thankful every day that I'm doing it.
Oh, that's so beautiful to hear, because I always used to think, okay, we're going to make a vegan world. We're going to go out there. We're going to change everybody. And, you know, I'm sure that will happen at some point in time. But I'm very sobered by the fact that for as far as we've come, and we have come so far, that mainstream addiction or connection or just a desire that was created before we were even verbal, it's just so hard for people to kick. And it's so much a part of almost every culture. I'm sure you've heard this too. People will say, well, you know, I'd go vegan, but I'm Italian. Oh, I'd go vegan, but I'm French. Well, I could go vegan, but I'm Jewish. It's like, whatever.
Right.
But this world, unless you're a Jane, loves animal products and has for generations. Yeah. So it's going to be a transition.
It is. Yeah. But we can do it bit by bit. We plant those seeds. Yeah.
And to celebrate it, and just there is a certain happiness every day, as you talk about just in knowing that you're not contributing to that suffering. Maybe you can't change the world. Maybe you can't save everybody, but at least you're doing that. So that's good.
It is good. So you've been pretty busy lately, and you were just traveling, right, to the Parliament of the World's Religions.
Yes, and I think I look like the Parliament of the World's Religions because I got my stuff behind me. You know, I'm part of the Compassion Consortium, which is an interfaith, interspiritual, interspecies center for animal advocates. And you actually read our Tenets of Agreement for the most recent Sunday celebration. Thank you so much for that. But I'm in my Compassion Consortium background. So, but yes, I had heard of the Parliament of the World's Religions for many years because the first one happened in 1893. Wow. And at that parliament, Swami Vivekananda came from India. He was the first yogi to travel from India to the West. So this meeting in Chicago was just something that I had known about for such a long time. And they started doing them again in 1993, but I didn't find out about that. And so what was so great about this year was that it was back in Chicago where it had happened the first time. And we had a really commanding vegan presence. Yes. There were, I believe, 30 workshops, panels, and films from animal rights and vegan people. And it wasn't obviously the majority. And for most of our presentations, it wasn't like we were filling the whole room and people were having to wait outside the door, but we were there. Mm-hmm. We were making a stand. And I'm sure that over time, people have had to make stands for lots of issues, for lots of human rights issues, for lots of groups who were not welcome into things. And we're doing that now for the animals. And I don't know how long it'll take. I just know we were there and we did that. And most people seemed really open and some people seemed really afraid because veganism is tied to lots of things. And you can talk about climate change and you can talk about workers' rights and you can talk certainly about animal rights and health, and then there are different views on health. And so it's not the easiest topic to talk about in a group where people all see things from the way they see things, which mm-hmm. is true, I guess, with any group of people. But the fact that so many people were excited by what we had to say was really very gratifying. And then of course the Jains were there with their beautiful presence, and they haven't always been vegan because in India there's this relationship with dairy, but the young Jains are very much promoting veganism. And it was just nice to have that kind of like unofficial partnership. We knew that whatever we were doing, you know, we Western folks talking about veganism, that there were these wonderful people from India who had that in their tradition and their current practice as well. And then lots of vegetarians. There was a beautiful celebration every day called a langar by the Sikh community. And they served 2,000 people in this tent. And you went in, took off your shoes, somebody put a little hat thing, little covering on everybody's head, males and females. You washed your hands, and then you're led into this wonderful space. And unless you had a disability, you sat on the floor. And then they come and bring this beautiful, simple Indian meal. They did have yogurt, but as far as I know, everything other than the yogurt was vegan. And to just be able to be there and experience what somebody called radical service was just a magical, magical feeling. So it was a It was, even though I spoke five times, it felt like a vacation, and it was a good vacation.
That is wonderful. Oh my gosh. I love that, that there's becoming a vegan presence. I don't have a lot of experience with having conversations where people are kind of like, well, my religion says that, you know, X, Y, and Z, and we need to do this. But I know that some people do turn to the Bible and say, the Bible says we're supposed to eat animals. And I actually had a guest on last season, and that's his whole thing. He is like, nope, here's what you're reading, and here's what the Bible actually says, and yes, here's why it says that you're not supposed to eat them. And I love it. I love that we're having these conversations that are making people maybe think twice, like, huh, have I been reading this the way it was intended, or am I reading it through those glasses that my family and the tradition has kind of fed it to me through?
Well, I think with all the scriptures of the world, you kind of get what you're looking for. Mm-hmm. And if you're looking to be lifted up to a higher place, even if you don't really feel like doing the work, or even if it seems scary, or even if it seems hard, you read these incredible books, and even though, you know, they're not perfect and they've all been translated and heaven knows what, but there's some magic in there if you really come to them with an open mind and an open heart. And I think people will say, you know, religion has done a lot of harm in the world, it's done a lot of good in the world, but I think they're just magical vegan connections in all of these teachings. And certainly in the Bible, in Genesis, nobody can argue that Eden was vegan. I mean, nobody was eating anybody else in Eden. Even the animals that we would today call carnivores, everybody was eating plants. And it was this lovely, what I think of as the Hawaiian vacation diet, you know, fruits and nuts. And then after the fall, I find this so, so interesting. Whoever wrote Genesis had such an interesting insight, because it wasn't like, okay, now you fell, now you eat meat. Oh no, now you fell, you're still vegan, but now you're going to get the green plants. Because before there was sickness and death, you didn't have to eat kale. But now that you got to deal with that stuff, you know, the fruits and nuts need some help. And just all these interesting stories, and the Daniel story of how Daniel was captured by the enemy king, and he and his friends wouldn't eat the meat and wouldn't drink the alcohol, and they were stronger than the king's soldiers. But there's something else that I find so interesting, that's not specifically in the Bible, but it is historically documented. And that is that in very early Christianity, often called primitive Christianity, there were vegetarians, and I believe they were vegans, because I don't think in that day people would go to the trouble to raise animals for so-called byproducts. But there were, we'll just call them vegetarians, all over the place. And it is even in the Bible that St. Paul was very upset, like, would you just stop talking about your vegan diet? I mean, we really have more important things to deal with. But there are so many of the early church fathers, they're called, and female saints and others. There's actually a book called Vegetarian Christian Saints by Dr. Holly Roberts. And I find it so fascinating that even though nobody really knows what Jesus ate, or, you know, what he taught about that, or if overturning the, you know, money changers' tables in the temple was an act of animal rights, which it very much could have been. And a lot of people are arguing that it was. But what we do know is that there was evidently so much love that had been infused into the world at that time, that people for the next couple hundred years felt it enough that they wanted to live very kindly, many of them. So it's all cool and fun.
So you're one of the founders of the Compassion Consortium, right?
I am. It was actually the idea of my husband, William Melton, And then he and I came up with the name for it on a crosstown bus here in Manhattan. And then he presented it to Reverend Sarah Bowen, who was one of his teachers, in fact, his dean at One Spirit Seminary, where he had gotten his interfaith ministerial ordination. And she was an animal rights person and a vegan. So we have been around for a couple of years now to meet the spiritual needs of people who care about animals and of vegans and vegetarians. And so many people are connected to a religious tradition, but their veganism or their the way they see animals is just not celebrated there. They're not like ostracized, but it's just like, okay, you know, that's Joe and he does that thing. and then other people have actually left. And, you know, a lot of people leave faith communities because they just want to leave the faith community. But a lot of times people leave reluctantly and sadly. But as one woman said in one of our early services, I've been Baptist my whole life, but I just couldn't go back to that church after they roasted that pig. Mm. And I think so many people have these experiences. So we try to fill in the blanks at the Compassion Consortium. And we meet at 4 o'clock on a Sunday afternoons, 4 o'clock Eastern time, so that people that need Saturday for their other tradition or Sunday morning, you know, we're not trying to interfere with anything. Just be there with that beautiful idea that Albert Schweitzer expressed so well, to extend our circle of compassion to include all living beings. Mm, and yeah. It's so affirming. Yeah. You know, it's sort of like the more I can love everybody, the more I love me. Mm-hmm. You know, the less I'm prone to say, oh, how could you do something so stupid? I mean, I still say that sometimes, because sometimes I do things that are pretty stupid. But generally speaking, it's just the love goes out, the love comes back. And it's just a much better way to make one's way through Earth.
Yeah, I agree. I loved yesterday. I mean, I love every service I've attended. Yesterday's, I don't know, everything just, it was really exactly what I needed.
Aww.
And then when we got to fellowship, I actually wound up in a breakout room with William. And your question was, the question going into the breakout room was about like that having a moment where maybe like interacting with an animal or kind of brought about some spirituality, or at least that's what I heard. And so when William asked me to go first and share my response, I said, you know, I was kind of a staunch atheist, like my entire life, like even as a child, my parents, I went to Catholic school until second grade, but my parents, like my mom brought me to church because that's what she'd been raised in. Her parents, her mother was very adamant that, you know, we weren't going to be acceptable family members if we weren't meeting these requirements. And so she tried, and it just didn't take. And it actually pushed me away from any idea that religion could be a part of my life, or even spirituality could be a part of my life. And then, you know, I got older and kind of started to explore some things, and had even done a Reiki level one in 2019. But it wasn't until 2020, when my soul cat Cookie passed away, that I had this moment of, okay, I can't live in a world where this perfect cat just doesn't exist anymore. And, you know, in the past, and I've lost people who were important to me, not super close, not immediate family, but people who were important to me. And I still had the idea, well, when it's over, it's over. It all goes black and that's okay. And that was very much my attitude. But there was just something different with Cookie. And I just couldn't accept that she wasn't here in some form anymore. And that really got me exploring. And then when I found Compassion Consortium, I think last year, I was like, oh, these are my people.
Oh, I'm so glad we are. Oh, that's beautiful. And I know what you mean when you say soul cat. I had a soul cat. His name was Benjamin. Hmm. I've had other cats I love to pieces. My cat Albert is kind of saying to me now, I was a soul cat too. Okay, Benjamin and Albert. Soul. And then, oh, my dog Forbes, who left us last year. So quickly. I mean, he was gone 12 days after his diagnosis. And I mean, you just, the connection is so strong because it's so pure. And humans are so complicated. I mean, it's hard for us to even have a reasonable relationship with ourselves, much less other humans. But these other little beings, oh, bless you. Yeah, it's very, very tough to lose them. But I have just always had a sense from the time I was little bitty that this is, well, there was a beautiful book by this title by a gentleman, I can't remember now. I think his name might have been Goldstein. But anyway, the title of his book was A Parenthesis in Eternity. And that's what I always felt that this life was like. It's a parenthesis in eternity. It's a really important parenthesis. Like it kind of explains the whole book. But there was a before and there is an after. And there's probably a level in consciousness at which it's not even before and after. It's just all one and the same. And, you know, and I don't know the specifics and I don't think anybody does, but I think we can have these working hypotheses. I was communicating the other day with a lovely friend of mine, a Main Street Vegan Academy graduate who is very much an atheist. And she was saying, I just so appreciate it that you accept me so much knowing that I am an atheist. And it's like, you mean that because you've got one working hypothesis and I have another working hypothesis, and the truth is nobody really knows about stuff like that, that I would miss out on the opportunity to love you because our hypotheses are different? You know, that's, but I know out in the world, a lot of people are doing stuff like that. I know we're separated by religion and politics and in some cases dietary choices. So I just think it's important as much as we can to find every excuse to love that shows up.
Oh, I love that. Thank you for that. So you mentioned Main Street Vegan Academy.
Yes.
Let's talk about that. Do you have a new cohort starting soon?
I do. Yes. The 36th Main Street Vegan Academy will start September 9th via Zoom. And we have been training and certifying vegan lifestyle coaches and educators since 2012. And a lot of our graduates are coaching, but others are doing other things. You know, I didn't know when this came to me how amazing it was going to be. But we have a lot of graduates who come to the academy and then go out and start businesses. So we've got like bakeries and B&Bs and bodegas, and that's just the bees, and all kinds of amazing businesses. We have graduates on six continents, 33 countries. And there's something about the experience of Main Street Vegan Academy. And I think it's because it's interactive. It's in real time. So you get to actually talk to the instructors and you get to go back and forth and you get to hash things out. And then when it's over, unless you just say, okay, I'm done, I'm going on, you know, starting my food truck now, or you can stay connected. And we have so much interaction and support and networking. So we have graduates working for plant-based food companies and animal rights charities and people starting their own nonprofits. I mean, people just setting the world on fire in every kind of good way. And because I have no grandchildren and I probably won't, it's just cool to think, well, maybe I don't have those, but I have 650 graduates around the world who are just carrying the vegan message with food and knowledge and all kinds of amazing ways, including vegan, eco-friendly, made in America cowboy boots from Dallas. So if you need some cowboy boots, check her out, Kat Mendenhall. Very cool. I guess in Dallas, you've got to have those cowboy boots.
So
they just might not let you in places.
Yeah. So what is, tell me a little bit more about the course. Like, what do people expect to experience? Yeah.
Well, we have three tiers: vegan principles, communication principles, and business principles. Because what we want our graduates to go out into the world as is experts on the whole vegan lifestyle. Mm-hmm. So this means you get everything. And what's so interesting is that so many people come in and they know a lot about something, but not so much about everything. So we have intensive courses on animal rights and animal law, animal use in fashion, all that kind of stuff. Then we have nutrition with registered dietitian. We have at least one medical doctor, usually two, talking about the health aspects of eating in this way. And then we have the environment, which is just so difficult to wrestle with. Mm-hmm. And yet our instructor, Martin Rowe from the Culture and Animals Foundation and Brighter Green, which is an environmental action tank, he just lays it out in a way that it's like, okay, this is hard and I don't want to know. But now that I know what I'm going to do. Mm-hmm. And anytime something is scary or intimidating, just to know that you have an action plan is so wonderful. And then in the realm of communications, we teach people how to coach. And even those who don't want to be professional coaches, it's so good for talking with friends, relatives, somebody on the bus. Because the questions are always the same, and they're usually based on fear. Yeah. And then we have working with mixed and transitional families, public speaking, and then in our business section, it's all about branding yourself, starting a business. What if you've never had a business before? What's a DBA? What's an LLC? How are we going to do all this stuff? And then we have a lot about how to use the internet, both safety online and how to get that vegan message out there without getting caught up in the dark side of social media, you know, where people argue and it can be a downward spiral. And because the animals are counting on us, we don't have time for downward spirals. Right. So we want our people to really know how to use every tool to their best advantage and the animals' best advantage. And we have also time to practice and learn from one another. And it's just, you know, it's just the sweetest thing. I had no idea that I was going to start a business at 62. I'd never had a business. I'm a writer, you know, I'm an artist, but it was just meant to be. And the coolest thing is, you know, we can all do a lot and we can talk to people and we can influence people. And I think with somebody who has a podcast as you do, or somebody who's written books as I've done, we can reach a lot of people. But when you've got other people out there reaching people, it's like this ripple that goes on forever. So it's quite spectacular.
Yeah.
And I just invite everybody to check us out at mainstreetvegan.com. The course is spread out over 3.5 months. It's 7 weekend days. So we do start on September 9 and 10. But we record every class. So if maybe you're listening to this September 12th and you want to just still join, you could. So mainstreetvegan.com is our website. And if you do pay up front, we kind of like to reward that with a discount code, which is kindness15, capital K, and that gets you 15% off. And we also have another option, which is pay over time. So you can make smaller payments, and we do whatever we can to help you have this experience, because when you have it, you'll help more animals.
Yeah. Oh, I love it. That sounds amazing. Oh, how lucky cool. for everyone who's been through it and those who are signing up now.
It's, you know, sometimes things just work out right. Mm-hmm. And I never thought about doing this. It literally popped into my head because I had a vegan miracle. And I do think that there are more of those happening because this is the time for the animals to start to be recognized and to start to be noticed and to be valued. So what happened to me was I had written the proposal for my book, Main Street Vegan, and was thrilled that it got a really good publisher. And then I talked to my editor and she said, oh, we're so happy to have you in the book, but we hate Main Street. And it's like, but that's what it's supposed to be called. Anyway, they bought it. I had to come up with a different title and I couldn't. I was just totally stumped. And I ran into Michael Moore on the street, Michael Moore, the filmmaker. And he said, we need to talk. We need to talk about food. And so we started having these conversations and I explained to him about my book and how they didn't like the title. And he said, let me talk to them. It's a perfect title. So we had this three-way call with an Academy Award winner and my editor and me. He convinced her. She convinced the higher-ups. She called me 2 days later to say that Main Street Vegan was my title. And then all these other ideas started popping. There needs to be a Main Street Vegan podcast and production company and academy training vegan lifestyle coaches. And it was just like, it came through me, yeah. Not from me. Mm-hmm. And so I think that's why it's so magical and people go out and do such incredible things with it.
Yeah. Oh my gosh. Oh, what a great story. So you said two things that have prompted two other things I'm going to ask you about. So you mentioned your age before.
Yeah.
So I'd love to talk about, you have a focus on aging well as a vegan.
Yes.
And you even said, like, when we had our little intro call, you're like, it's not a panacea, but we, you know, we can age well being vegan. So what does that mean?
Well, having been around this world for a very long time. So I went vegetarian in 1969 and I got very active in this movement. And I was writing for lots of vegetarian publications. I was writing for the American Vegan Society because I kept trying to be vegan. All that time I was vegetarian, I was trying to be vegan. And so I've been watching people grow and have families and their kids grow up. And then, you know, we who were there a long time ago, we're getting old. And and I see how it goes. And in life, all animals, even plants, you know, you're born, you mature, you have the opportunity to reproduce, and then you kind of start to fade. And at some point, you're out of here. So to say, oh, you know, eternal youth and all that, that's like trying to stop the tide. So it's not that, but I have observed over all these years that generally speaking, and quite often, vegans just age better than other people. Now, this is not to say that some people don't get cancer. On rare occasions, there are even heart attacks that come earlier in life than we would think that they're supposed to come. Because this is Earth. And, you know, Earth is difficult. Yeah. But overall, I mean, vegans are out there doing amazing things. Yeah. And I'm thinking about, you know, people who are older than me. I'm 73. I think about, like, Dr. T. Colin Campbell and his wife, they're in their late 80s. And, you know, they're doing stuff. They're still in the work. Mm-hmm. It's a beautiful woman, a little bit older than me, out in Chicago, Karen Calabrese. And she's largely raw. And a lot of these raw food people, I mean, you know, they're like another species. And they really, you know, I mean, they maybe will have eternal youth. But she's just such a lovely woman. And about 10 years ago, she was in a serious car accident. I mean, one of these devastating accidents that a lot of people would not come back from. Mm. She's totally come back from it. with all of the vitality and beauty that she had before. And so why is this? You know, that's like, why is this? And part of it, I think, is the food. I mean, the fact is that if you are getting all these amazing phytochemicals and antioxidants and eating all these beautiful, brightly colored plants, you're feeding your cells rejuvenative elements.
Yeah.
And so it just makes sense. You know, it's like death in, death out, mm-hmm. and life force energy in, life force energy out. Yeah. So that is a huge part of it, I'm sure. But I also believe that part of it is karma. I wrote a book called The Good Karma Diet because I just really believe in all my heart and soul that when you're truly trying to include others in your choices, and when their well-being is on par with your own, the universe says, that is so cool. What do you want? Mm. I think we all want to feel good.
Yeah.
For as long as we can.
By the way, I finally got it from the library. It was on hold and it finally showed up.
I'm glad.
Awesome. Yeah. I think so too. The idea of like the universe saying, okay, what do you want? I just feel like my life and those I know who are vegan, it just is better since we made that change.
It is.
In and all ways.
Yes. And yeah. Even if somebody gets sick, and I'm thinking of some friends of mine in my age group now, longtime vegans who are dealing with health challenges, even then it's better because mm-hmm. that thing they talk about, general health, it's like, okay, the person has XYZ diagnosis, but you know, a lot of people, and we heard a lot about this during COVID, there were so many underlying conditions that it was just so difficult to overcome anything. Yeah. And what seems to happen when vegans get a diagnosis, it's the only one they've got. And it's the only one they have to fight and treat and deal with.
Yeah.
And so even a sick vegan, it's better. Everything about this way of life, it's a gift. Really, mm-hmm. truly is.
Yeah. It's so lovely. All right. So the next thing, because you mentioned Michael Moore, which got me thinking about film.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. You have a feature film in the works, don't you?
I do. Yeah. We do. It's actually William, my husband, who wrote, he was still vegetarian. He hadn't quite become vegan yet. And he just had this idea that he wanted to write this film about a cow who escapes from a slaughterhouse. But he didn't know cows. We're from the Midwest, but we're from a city. We're from Kansas City. So we never were around cows. So he took a month and went upstate and got a place very close to Farm Sanctuary so that he could be around cows. And I think that was a lot of what moved him over to become vegan. And the story is absolutely gripping. It has a surprise ending that's like M. Night Shyamalan in his early days.
Oh, wow.
It's a great story. And then William brings this story home. And because I'm a writer, I mean, I'm a nonfiction writer, so I can't come up with stories, but I know how to do words. And so then we started working on it together. And we've had input over the years from some remarkable people. Gene Bauer from Farm Sanctuary has been on board from the beginning. Mm-hmm. And so Alicia Silverstone helped out for a while. James Cromwell helped out for a while. And then, you know, people at that level of success in Hollywood and all very often kind of move on. but we do have this incredible input. And now things are really starting to happen. So we are raising the development funds. We're actually going to be doing a crowdfunder later in the fall, but we have some very nice seed money. We have a very kind and generous promise of matching funds, so that once we've got this chunk of development money, our producer, who is a lovely man up in Canada, can go out and really get things going to get into production. So it's incredibly exciting because the time is now for a family feature film that has a vegan protagonist. Our lead is Patricia Levinson. She's a lawyer, and she's known to the press as Cow Patty because she does all this pro bono legal work. And when this cow escapes from a slaughterhouse in a small town in the Midwest, and her old NYU classmate calls her for help, she shouldn't go because she's newly divorced and she's trying to make partner at her firm because now she has to support herself, but she shows up out there anyway. It's a great story. And our target audience is regular American, you know, families, people that are saying, okay, let's see, I'm a single dad. I've got my kids this weekend. What are we going to do? I guess we'll go to McDonald's and then we'll go see this movie with a cow in it. And so it's not for people who would go watch a vegan documentary. This is for people who are looking for a good story. And the history of film is just full of good stories that also change society. And we're hoping that Miss Liberty will be one of those.
Oh, I got goosebumps. I can't wait. Well,
thank you.
I will be there.
Yay.
To see it when it's ready. Yeah.
We'll invite you to the premiere.
Oh, fantastic. I'm right in New Jersey. New York is right there.
Yes.
Victoria, this has been wonderful. What a lovely, engaging, and just beautiful conversation we've had tonight.
We have, right?
We
should hang out. If you're just in New Jersey, we should, you know, meet for green juice.
Yeah, let's do that. I have one more question for you.
Yes.
On Did You Bring the Hummus? We've got to talk about hummus. So tell me about your favorite hummus, or maybe your favorite way to eat hummus, or maybe both.
Yeah, I like the roasted red pepper hummus. Mm-hmm. And I actually like it on raw vegetables. And that's not, you know, that I'm like a super health nut or something, because it's also good on baked potatoes, now that I'm thinking about that.
Yeah.
But there's this tangy flavor, I guess, from the tahini. And so when you have it with raw vegetables, they're just watery enough, you know, juicy enough to kind of work well with the hummus. So yeah, beautiful crudité platter and some of that roasted red pepper hummus.
Yeah.
Oh, that's
that
good.
Good. I have some in my fridge, so I think I know what my before bed snack will be.
Yum.
Good stuff. Victoria, thank you so, so much.
Thank you, Kimberly. It was a pleasure.
Welcome back. What inspired you most from this discussion? A few things stood out to me. I loved when Victoria spoke about the power of choice, so much so that it became the title of this episode. How it's so much easier to be and stay vegan, as well as making other positive changes, when someone else's life is at stake. It's so easy to ditch a new way of living when we're only thinking about ourselves in the immediate. But when we expand that circle of compassion, as Albert Schweitzer says, it's a heck of a lot easier to stay on that path we want for the long-term impact that matters to us. I also really loved when Victoria said, "The more I can love everybody, the more I can love me," which to me ties right back to that Albert Schweitzer quote I just mentioned. To get in touch with Victoria, visit her websites, victoriamoran.com or mainstreetvegan.com. Find her on social media at Victoria Moran Author and at Main Street Vegan. And as always, you'll find all of these links in the show notes. I hope you found this episode helpful and inspiring. Please subscribe to the podcast so you never miss an episode. And if you're loving it, please give Did You Bring the Hummus a 5-star rating and leave a review. it's an easy way to keep supporting the show. Be sure to share these episodes with your friends. If you're finding something good here, they will too. If you're a vegan or know a vegan who would be a great fit for the podcast, follow the Be a Guest link in the show notes. Fill out the quiz and I'll be in touch. I also have a new freebie on my website. Sign up for my mailing list and get a PDF of 3 amazing vegan recipes. Chocolate chip cookies, vegan chicken parm, and some great tips on building bowls, which makes making dinner on the weeknights or when you're super busy, super easy. Follow me on Facebook and Instagram at Did You Bring the Hummus, and visit my website, didyoubringthehummus.com, for more information about me, updates on what I'm working on, new podcast episodes, and all things vegan. Finally, I would love to hear from you. What do you need help with? Is there a topic you want to hear covered on a future episode? DM me on Instagram or send me an email at didyoubringthehummus@gmail.com. Thanks for listening.